We'll now take a closer look at Kosti Kunubii, Pius XI's response to eugenics, and indeed his great encyclical on the subject of Christian marriage. But it is important to bear in mind that the circumstances that evoked this very extensive papal discussion was the phenomenon of the widespread practice of, endorsement of, and sense of the rightness of eugenics. He attempts to redefine marriage or to correctly interpret marriage in light of classical traditional definitions in a way that highlights the fact that his fundamental assumption is that the state should be at the service of marriage. That is, it should protect and defend marriage as the Church understands it, rather than attempting to impose unions or forbid unions on the basis of some arbitrary criteria of what constitutes the good of the race or the good of the species. So he is responding to a very strong tide of support for eugenics, the details of which we'll see a little bit later on, and his is one of the lone voices speaking out against it. As we'll see, and as we've mentioned before, historians of the eugenics movement are forced to concede, whatever their own background or appreciation or lack of appreciation of the Church is, to admit that it really was the Catholic Church which stood alone among Christian entities as absolutely opposed to abortion. Now, this is not to say that every Catholic theologian, every notable Catholic leader, spoke out against eugenics. There are some exceptions, unfortunately, as we'll see, but overwhelmingly the magisterium made it clear that this notion of eugenics was absolutely opposed to what was regarded as the supernatural and natural good of the relationship between man and woman lived out in the context of the sacrament of marriage. So if we look at the text itself, we can situate these statements about eugenics, beginning with number 7, and I should add that all the portions that are in dark blue with white text are my own comment and my own introduction to the sections. They are not actually part of the official document, but the first section really is about the Pope's conviction that the state should support the institution of marriage and not use its coercive power to effectively defeat the real aims and ends of marriage. So if we look at number 7, he describes the nature of a sacred and inviolable bond that comes into existence as a result of the contracting parties joined and knit together. Reminding ourselves that the sacrament of marriage is unique, as John Paul II in his Theology of the Body reminded the faithful, it is unique in that it is the one sacrament that, according to the tradition of the Church, descends to us from our unfallen nature. There is no other sacrament that predates the fall. So there is in matrimony a very powerful and beautiful reminder of the nature of the Trinity, as we've noted before, and so its protection by the state is paramount to the protection of human beings and human society in general. So in number 8 he says, legitimately constituted authority has the right and the duty to restrict, prevent, and punish those base unions which are opposed to reason and to nature. Now, he does not mean by base unions marriages or relationships that are likely to produce what might be defined as defective offspring, but on the contrary, unions that are not marriage. That is, the state should not support individuals living together who are not committed in a union that leads to the goods of marriage. So he's convinced that the state should support the institution by not encouraging anything other than married unions. That is what is opposed to reason and to nature. And then he goes on in number 8, and here you see him responding to the notion that the state should coercively limit the capacity to reproduce in certain circumstances, rather like Nietzsche and Galton had already encouraged. He says, the Pope says, to take away from man the natural and primeval right of marriage, to circumscribe in any way the principal ends of marriage, laid down in the beginning by God himself in the words increase and multiply, is beyond the power of any human law. So the state and the legal profession may not interfere with the right of individuals or the natural end of marriage, which is to say the fruitfulness of marriage that can result in the production of a child. And he concludes in number 9, the partnership of true marriages is constituted both by the will of God and the will of human beings. So his conviction is that the state ought to support the institution and not coercively try to force its own notions of what is right onto marriage by forbidding certain marriages and encouraging others. He then goes on to describe, and we'll look at this relatively briefly, what marriage is understood to be according to the teaching of the Catholic Church. And he quotes in number 10, St. Augustine, that the goods of marriage, the bounty of marriage is proles, offspring, fides, conjugal faith, and sacramentum, the sacrament. And he explains these three terms. Faith is faithfulness in the relationship, that the couple is faithful to each other, that there is an absolute proscription of adultery. There is no such thing as an open marriage where people believe they have the right or that they should be encouraged to have relationships outside of marriage. Offspring, proles, means not only that there should be children, but that they should be cared for and educated in a religious atmosphere. So these things are to be encouraged and even maintained, you would think, by the state, by state laws. And finally, the sacramental aspect is that marriage cannot be broken, that it is for life. And so these three categories are the traditional ways of describing marriage in the theology of the Church. And among the blessings of marriage, the child holds the first place. And he is emphasizing this by reminding the faithful and indeed the restrictive governments. This is the 1930s. The eugenics movement is advancing very rapidly in Europe and especially in Germany, that decreeing that people may not have children is not the place of the state. The child holds the first place among the blessings of marriage. And then if we drop down to number 13, it's not just a question of having children, but for the faithful, it is children who are destined to become members of the Church. So they have the right to be raised in a Catholic context and to be made aware of the moral traditions and inheritance that they've received. Then, dropping way down, I mean, we've skipped quite a lot here in the document in number 63, he describes this eugenic liberalization, particularly of the abortion laws, as a very great crime. Taking the life of the offspring hidden in the mother's womb, even for reasons that they call medical, social, or eugenic, is absolutely wrong. And he says that there should be no government support for this, which, of course, is the opposite of what's happening. The government is not only supporting, but going on in some cases to require this, particularly in individuals who are regarded as likely to produce defective offspring, according to the eugenicists' definitions. And in number 64, he says, what could ever be a sufficient reason for excusing in any way the direct murder of the innocent? No medical or therapeutic indication, no eugenic indication, and indeed, he says, as we've noted before, the child cannot be regarded as an unjust aggressor for those who might seek to justify abortion from that perspective. Then, in number 66, number 66 may seem a little puzzling because he says that eugenic indications, what is asserted in favor of eugenic indications, may and must be accepted providing lawful and upright methods are employed within the proper limits. Now, he is not here endorsing the pseudoscience of eugenics, but recognizing that sometimes the promoters of eugenics describe legitimate concerns, such as the question of a person who is incapable of rational thought, a person whose ability to negotiate ordinary activities of daily living might be restricted or restrained in terms of their activities of daily living in order to protect them, not so much to prevent them from experiencing life, but rather to protect them from being, for example, sexually abused and thus being made pregnant against their will. So the idea that there might be institutions where people are not given the freedom of sexual access to one another could be permissible if it were done in a lawful and moral and legitimate sort of way. As we'll see, he's concerned, however, that this kind of a notion would be abused, and indeed it was used quite a lot. He points out evil cannot be done, that good may come of it. That is, you can't use an evil means, such as abortion or sterilization, as a means of attaining what in some rare circumstances might actually be a legitimate end, and particularly an end of protecting a vulnerable individual from a pregnancy they could never understand or never take responsibility for. And he says in number 67 that those who hold the reins of government should never forget it is the duty of public authority to defend the lives of the innocent. And among the innocent, whom we mention, the first place belongs to infants hidden in the mother's womb. And then his direct opposition to eugenics is expressed very clearly in number 68. We condemn particularly with regard to that pernicious practice that touches on the right of human beings to enter into matrimony, but affects their welfare, for there are some who over-solicitous for the cause of eugenics not only give appropriate counsel for people as regards their marriages, which is appropriate, he says, not contrary to right reason, to offer marriage counseling, but they put eugenics before aims of a higher order, and by public authority wish to prevent from marrying all those whom, even though naturally fit for marriage, they consider would be likely to bring forth defective offspring. So he's here specifically describing those who advocate hygiene, social or racial hygiene, and who are claiming the ability to predict and therefore to prevent the genetic defects by preventing certain kinds of unions. These eugenicists wish the civil authority to arrogate to itself a power over a faculty which it never had and can never legitimately possess. And we've looked at this text before. The family is more sacred than the state. We are created not for earth, but for heaven and for eternity. And he concludes, where there has been no crime, as we noted before, there can be no tampering with the integrity of the body. That is, there certainly can be no forcible sterilization. So, Christians, he points out, are not free to destroy or mutilate their members, not free to consent to this kind of sterilization procedure, even if the state mandates it. And as we'll see, the Church's absolute opposition to this meant that the Nazi policy in Germany had to allow a conscience exemption for Catholics, recognizing that Catholic physicians would not cooperate with the eugenic movement.